Okay, today is August 26th, 2013, and I'm here at Alice Kelly's office to interview her and find out about her experiences with the Climate Change Institute. So just to get us started off, I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about how you got involved in, it's a blend of archaeology and geology.
Right. Goes back to the mid-1980s when I came here with my husband to Orono, and I was working as a consulting geologist in the area. And his link was as being based here as part of the Maine Geological Survey. And so I got to tag along on some of the field trips. I met David Sanger, who is now a retired faculty member here. And we started talking about geology and archaeology, and I'd had a long-term interest in archaeology. And he took me to we were at a site as part of a field trip, showed me some artifacts, talked about the archaeology of the area, and I was hooked. That was it. And I became very interested in the archaeology of this part of the world. And one thing led to another, and I found myself in an individualized PhD program.
What was the name of the site?
The site that we were at was Machiasport. It's on the coast in Washington County. It's okay. An eroding shell midden.
Mm. And some of the artifacts he showed you were from Aborigines from the Holocene?
It was from the, about 4,000 years ago, so mid-Holocene. Mm-hmm. Was what archaeologists in this part of the world refer to as the ceramic period.
Okay.
Late archaic to early ceramic period, so mm-hmm. between 4,000 and 3,000 years.
So you would say that you would trace your interest in interdisciplinary work back to that moment?
Yeah, I would say that's when it all really came together.
Yeah. What about geology itself? Was that something that you were fascinated with from an early age, or?
I think that went along with the archaeology, but I've been interested in geology since a ninth grade earth science class, and my real interest was in how landscapes form. I like to hike, I like to camp, I was outside from an early age, my parents liked to hike and camp, mm-hmm. and so suddenly realizing that the landscapes that you could see had a geological beginning and evolution. And my ninth grade teacher was very good at explaining that. Mm. And so that's where the geology part came in. So I followed that right into undergraduate school and my master's as well.
Where did you go for your undergraduate?
My undergraduate work was at Westchester State University in Pennsylvania. A Bachelor's of Science in Earth Science Education, followed by a Master's in Geology at Lehigh University in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
Okay. And then you did your PhD here at the University of Maine.
I did. There was a bit of an academic hiatus. I worked for Bethlehem Steel while I was working on my Master's. And then I worked for Chevron USA as a research offshore research for oil and gas for 3 years in New Orleans, and then came here, worked a bit as a private consultant, and then started my PhD program, which was the long-term PhD with kids and jobs and
sure.
stuff. So I graduated in 2006.
Mm. What kind of work did you do with Bethlehem Steel?
I was an exploration geologist, so looking for metals, iron ore, lead, silver, zinc deposits in Mexico. Iron ore was primarily in Pennsylvania, and then coal in the Appalachians.
Mm-hmm. And you say you've been living in the Orono area since the mid-80s?
The early 80s, yeah.
Early 80s,
yeah.
Okay. So you've had sort of an affiliation with the members of what was then the Quaternary Institute for some time.
Oh, yes.
Did you know others besides David Sanger?
Oh, sure. Hal Bourne's, who was then to be on my committee, Dan Belknap, also on my PhD committee. Let's see, George Jacobson, George Denton, Terry Hughes, you know, the whole cast of characters at that point. It was a smaller smaller group. People tended to know each other. Even though I wasn't a member of the Institute, because Dr. Sanger was, we often were drawn into the annual field trip because our work was here in Maine. And so that was, we did field trip stops a few times.
Now, do you think your experiences, your involvement with the Institute was different because being one of the few females that's been affiliated with it? I understand there are perhaps three female faculty members now, or four, but when you were there, did you think that your experience was different in any way because you were a female?
No. Student-professor relationship, as being one of the students in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a difference between graduate students and professors, some with some more than others. But generally, no. And I've, in geology, I have certainly encountered some differences, but not with that group.
Mm-hmm. Could you maybe elaborate on some of the differences you encountered in geology?
In business, working in quarries, working in mines. When I was doing this, it was in the late 70s and then very early 80s, and particularly in mining, it wasn't very common to have a woman geologist or a woman who was in charge of a project. And so with some people, and not all, but some men found that a little hard to swallow, particularly a young female that was, you know, when that wasn't a setting. But not huge, not a problem. It's just one of the things you deal with.
So shifting back, when you decided to earn a PhD with the Institute, what topic did you ultimately settle on for your dissertation?
My dissertation topic was the archaeological geology of the Penobscot River Valley. So I was looking at the geological development of the valley since deglaciation, combined with the settlement history of people in the area. Although we don't have a lot of information about those early inhabitants, we can make some inferences from where things are found in other areas. So looking at how people were changing location due to landscape, how landscapes evolved, and the human-landscape interaction.
How would you say the Penobscot and the surrounding valley has changed in the last 5,000 years or so?
In 5,000 years? The real big changes were earlier.
All right.
Okay, shall we go there?
Let's do that.
Okay, we'll do that. If you look at the deglacial history of this area, about 12,000 years ago, where we were sitting, or 13,000, depending on how you would date things, where we are sitting right now was under probably 30 feet of water. And it was a full Arctic sea with whales and walruses and everything that you might expect, say, if you were in the coast of Greenland. This is because as the land surface was depressed by the weight of the ice, the ocean followed the ice as the ice receded across the coast of Maine and up into the major river valleys like the Penobscot and the Kennebec. So as that ice disappeared from the area, the land surface then began to rise with the weight of the ice removed from that area. And so it began to rise, and so this area went from full marine conditions to estuarine conditions to the freshwater valley that you see today. So that there's been a real change along the coast of Maine from this marine setting to a terrestrial setting. In the Penobscot Valley, there's also a complication of as that adjustment takes place, there may be a bulge of mantle material from deep within the earth, which is moving along because it's very viscous. And so not all the recovery from the removal of that ice takes place immediately, but we have this bulge that can migrate following the ice sheet. And in this area, in the headwaters of the Penobscot, was just enough to change the tilt of the landscape so that Moosehead Lake, which in the early Holocene, 10,000 years ago, drained into the Penobscot drainage, giving all of that melt water and water in that watershed into the Penobscot, shifted as this bulge moved through and the northern end of the lake moved up, and the Kennebec became the outlet for Moosehead and changed, of course, that river from a smaller river to the large river that it is today. Mm-hmm. That was part of my work, but, you know, in working with that with other people. But so there have been profound changes here, marine to freshwater, changing drainage patterns, and then the sorts of changes that you see with vegetation changes, things that were streams and open lakes becoming wetlands, you know, very productive wetlands that people wanted to live next to, which now, if you visit that area now, is a bog, and you wouldn't think much about a group of people wanting to be there much at all. Mm-hmm. So, profound changes.
And so, what were some of the human connections that you related to that?
The human connections would be how people early on were moving through the landscape, thinking that waterways, if not using boats, were probably at least an easy way to move, to follow a river into an area. Also, these changes that we saw from large lakes to then productive wetland, then to less productive peat bog, seeing people moving into an area, using an area, and then sites being abandoned, and focus going to other areas. Mm. Looking at places where changes in river flow and tidal circulation in the ocean would then bring fish, so anadromous fish coming up into valleys. So the linkage, it's a not just a people and landscape, but it's people and resources associated with that landscape. Mm-hmm. And the landscape.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. How do you see your work fitting in with the overall goals and aims of the Climate Change Institute?
Well, my work, that work which I did in Maine, and then current work that I'm doing in Peru with Dan Sandweiss, mm-hmm. That is looking at past climate changes, looking at the drivers of climate change, which my side of it is, again, looking at landscapes, and looking at how people and societies have responded to past climate change, which gives us some information on how we may respond to continuing climate change. I think another really important part of the group is the interdisciplinarity aspect. I work with archaeologists, geologists, climate specialists, looking at ice core records for information on how climate has changed, palynologists, a whole range of people who each have a particular technique or skill to bear on a problem, and we use all of that information to look at a big picture. And when you grow up academically in the situation like I did here with my PhD, you take that for granted, that you're going to work with various people. And if you don't know, you'll just find somebody who can help you fill in one particular piece of the puzzle. Mm-hmm. It's not like that at a lot of other places. And we have something really special here with this group that works together. And that's probably one of the strongest things and one of the best outcomes of the Institute approach of having people with many different specialties and backgrounds working together to address various issues.
What would you say has been the Climate Change Institute's greatest contribution to our understanding of climate change?
It's hard to single out one. I think really understanding past climate change, putting a great deal of effort into understanding the timing and processes of past climate change, which has then led to an understanding of the triggers of climate change. Climate and many of the landscape-related factors of climate change happen very much in a threshold situation where things are constant, nothing is changing until some factor is exceeded, and then be it a flood or a weather pattern change or something happens as a result of this building seemingly equilibrium situation, which then exceeds a threshold. There's been, the group has worked very, you know, broadly on timing of onset of glaciations and terminations, and has made some major contributions in that. I think for, in the archaeological side, it's looking at this linkage between humans and climate and humans and landscapes. That archaeology is not just material culture, but there's a whole environmental aspect we've in that area. And then understanding the world's great ice sheets, you know, from Antarctica to Greenland, and the ones that are no longer here. So on many fronts, great, but through all of it, the interdisciplinarity comes out as a group that has really worked together in a variety of fields.
Since you first got involved with the Institute in the early 80s, how has it changed?
Changed in perhaps size and scope. It was a much smaller group, all at the University of Maine, or virtually everyone at the University of Maine. Now it's much broader. We have colleagues from institutions all over the world. As the science has grown and we see more climate change related impacts over a broader number of fields, we brought in more disciplines. So I think we've gone from a focus on the quaternary and much of the past into including that past and looking toward the present and the future. Mm-hmm. And then, so that would be the scope change, and then the size of the Institute, the number of people who are involved.
Mm-hmm. Has the increasing number of members of the Institute, has that made it difficult to maintain a certain level of cohesion?
That's a leading question. anytime you bring more people into a group, it presents challenges. Just simply conveying information, trying to know many more people. I think there are certainly some challenges of trying to make sure that everybody knows what everyone else is doing, how we could work together more profitably. We've come a long way in using the Bourne Symposium as a vehicle to do that. But yeah, I can't know everyone as well when we have so many members as perhaps when the group was smaller. But we've brought in, you know, with anything, you've brought in more expertise, broadened horizons. So anytime something changes, there are new challenges.
Mm-hmm. There are a number of different disciplines involved in the Institute. Has it been, do you think, maybe more difficult for the archaeologists in the Institute to collaborate with their colleagues, simply because, for example, some of the climatologists who collect ice cores are going back sometimes 100,000 years, whereas archaeologists tend to deal with artifacts maybe going back 10,000 years.
Hmm.
So
I think it would be to look at places of intersection of ideas and expertise. And I'm not conversant on atmospheric chemistry changes, you know, 100,000 years ago, simply because that's not an area in my time frame. But in looking at how that record is developed, certainly can be instructive for looking at past and future changes. There is certainly direct application in the parts of those ice cores that overlap with time periods that I'm interested in, changing weather patterns. I'm working on a project in the Shetland Islands looking at sand inundation of farmland, coastal farmland. There's always been a view that there's been a link to Little Ice Age storminess. But what is it about the storminess that makes this happen? Mm-hmm. And why just then? Are they older? What are the conditions? And so if I want to know something about conditions in the Northern Hemisphere, in the far north, the Arctic of the Northern Hemisphere, the Greenland Ice Cap is a really nice repository of records. And I can't really interpret that data on my own. But yet I have someone in the building next door who can. And because of his long experience with ice cores, that particular segment is easy for him to interpret. So I think there's we look at a shorter time frame than some people do. Geologists look at 4.6 billion years of time versus the time, you know, with our Holocene interests. So it just is an overlap. And I don't... Is it good? Is it bad? I'm not, you know... It depends on where emphasis is or focus.
Mm-hmm. Can you think of specific examples where, say, other researchers involved with the Institute contributed to your own research or vice versa?
Oh, great. Constantly. I don't think I could do what I do without working with other colleagues in the Institute. I've worked closely with David Sanger for a very long time. He's retired in name only. We still collaborate.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a nice continuation. Dan Sandweiss and I work very closely together. But we also work with people who do, as my example of the Shetlands and the ice cores, you know, looking at past climate change. Work in Peru ties closely to El Nino events. So they're talking to oceanographers, helps, and we have oceanographers in our group. Looking at issues of sea level change, we have colleagues who are specialists in looking at sea level change. We've used palynology as a dating tool and also as a way to understand changing environments. So I wouldn't be nearly as successful at doing what I do without all of these other folks to help.
Mm. So in today's political climate, outside the scientific community, climate change is still up for debate. Do you have any views on why that might be the case?
Oh, one is protection of self-interest, being afraid of change, not seeing something as being, you know, immediate, tangible, overall distrust of science. I mean, I think all of these things go in. If I don't really understand it, it's easier just not to go there. And I think the current political situation, which casts things in very partisan light, so you either are on one side or the other, and your mind is made up depending on which group you want to be part of. I've talked to colleagues who work in Texas, and they said, you don't talk about climate change in the oil industry, even if you work in the oil industry. It's bad business. So I think there are a lot of factors that go into it. But it's a real problem for the country and the globe, because it's there.
What does the Climate Change Institute do, or does it do anything really, to try to insert itself in that debate?
I think we've become a bit more proactive than we have in the past, but mostly through public education, websites, streaming talks, becoming involved in some of the climate issues. We had a forum 2 years ago, I believe, which was about climate change in all sorts of different venues, not just what people might see as completely geological or atmospheric, but into music and the arts and a variety of different topics. So it's education. Whether people want to listen or not is yet another story. But I think I would be involved in the planning for climate change in Maine with a previous administration. Most of the, if not all the authors on that report were from the University of Maine and were from the Climate Change Institute. Now that's been shelved right now by the current administration, but it's there and it's good work.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that about is all of the questions I have, but before we conclude the interview, I do want to give you a chance to maybe add something that I didn't ask you about.
I think the Institute has grown. It's changed. I think that those changes have been a result of changes in the understanding of climate and the continuing interdisciplinary narrative of science. We don't work on our own pigeonholes, and we haven't for a long time. And that was what this group was founded on, was the recognition that specialists working together can produce a more holistic approach to a variety of questions. Increase in numbers, as you pointed out earlier, can have some issues, but it also provides a lot of opportunities. And we've had a great impact, I think, through the work of individuals and individuals working together on the science toward the issue of climate change and of educating the next generation of professionals, both in academia and outside of in the business world or out in the broader world market, and understanding the importance of other viewpoints, the importance of bringing in other disciplines in your work, and of course then the issue of climate change.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Sure.
Once again.
All right.
Go ahead and stop the recording.